Blog Talk Radio.
Those that don't work, those that are on welfare, those that have nothing.
We'll help you. You help us get up there. You help us get rid of some of these people that are pressing down on us.
No, I say you should be just as active in your neighborhood as we're trying to, as you have been in our neighborhood.
Everybody's going for something. We alone, there are too few of us. There are too many men up there with all their cop cars and everything.
That's what they're always telling you. Never let your enemy tell you how many of you there are. Never let the man that you're against form your opinion. This is the trick that's played on everyone who's oppressed. The first thing, an occupation, when you have a revolution in the country, the first thing you take over is the radio. And then you start telling the people that everybody, the war is over. And so all of them surrender. No, they believe that thing right there. And once they take that over, they start telling you where you are and where they are, and you fall right in line. It's plain thought control. The majority of the American people aren't segregationists. That the majority of the American people aren't imperialists. But the government is, the structure is, the power faction is. So, how then do all the majority go along with it? Because those who sit in power over the television, over the radio, and over the press is constantly telling those who are the masses how free they are. And how this they are and how that they are. So a mistake is made on your part when you think that white people suffer the same as black people. Or as many Jews will say, well, we're a minority too. Or the Irish will say, well, we used to be a minority. No one's a minority like we are. They didn't need civil rights legislation to solve any other minority problem. It didn't take a civil war to solve any other minority problem. It didn't take Supreme Court decisions to solve any other minority problem or legislation. It takes none of that other kind of that action to solve the minority problems of these other people. The only real minority in America is the Afro-American. Now, when white people, who are oppressed and poor, supposedly, but the poorest white person can go where the richest black person can't go. It isn't only poverty of in money. That we're talking about, poverty in spirit, poverty in freedom, poverty in equality, poverty in human dignity. This is the kind of poverty we're suffering from. So that the richest Negro in this country is still poor. When it comes to freedom, he's broke. When it comes to human dignity, he's broke. This is the kind of poverty we're talking about. So when you find white people who are poor, with all these doors that there are open to them, any door that you knock on, if you qualify, it'll open. So when you find a poor white person, he's in bad shape. You didn't know.
Oh, yeah. You know, I never, ever, never let the devil get the best of me. Yeah. I saw the preacher taking nickels from the welfare babies. Whoa, whoa, judge it, watch out for the young and the innocent. Yeah, yeah. Protect the riot, reject the wrong.
Without human consciousness, there is no world. It is the presence of human consciousness that brings meaning into the world. Without human beings in this world, conscious human beings in this world, in effect, there would not be a world. We bring the world into being through our consciousness. And through our consciousness, we create the world we live in. Out of the totality of reality, our consciousness cuts out a world that's a bit itself. In other words, the kind of world you exist in reflects the kind of consciousness that you have. And notice, if you change your consciousness or change your values and orientation, you enter into a different world. You interact with different people. People often that you didn't even know existed in the world. Social situations that you might not have even recognized until you entered into a new level of consciousness. You see people, say, for instance, who become addicted, say, to crack or something, and now enter into a whole world and enter into a whole social system that before they became addicted, they hardly noticed. They didn't know what it was all about. And they picked up new friends and new relations, whole new ways of acting, whole new purposes in life. They lost old friends, broke with old families, all kinds of things. In other words, the consciousness, that addictive consciousness, brought into the world a new foreground and put other things into the background. Therefore, man's consciousness is a creative act. And the kind of consciousness you have will determine the kind of world you create. And consequently, when you look at the world that we live in, African people, we must recognize to a great extent it is a world of our own creation. It is a world that has been generated by the type of consciousness we've been permitted to be instilled in us. consciousness.
Shock of what happened here 7 days ago has for many county employees turned into the fear that somehow it might happen again. To put the available pieces to this story together, one must go back in time, beginning with last Friday's 34-minute ordeal, recorded by photographers Jim Keene and Roger Bachrath in the San Rafael Independent Journal.
Unlike America would have us believe, the greatest problem confronting this country today is not pollution and bad breath. It's black people. It's black people. See, that's just one of the big lies that America tells you and that you go for because you chumps. You go for it. One of the lies that we tell ourselves is that we are making progress. But here his chair is empty. We're not making progress. We tend to equate progress with concessions. We can no longer make that mistake. You see, when they gave us that nigger astronaut, you say we were making progress, but I told you they were going to lose him in space. He didn't get that far. You put Adam Powell in office and you couldn't keep him. What you think they're going to do with Thurgood Marshall when they get tired of him? They gave you Walter Washington of Washington, D.C., and you said we were making progress. That's not progress. See, it's no in-between. You're either free or you're a slave. There's no such thing as second-class citizenship. But a lot of you running around talking about you Democrats, and the Democrats got you in the biggest trick going. They tell you it ain't our fault. It's the Dixocrats. No such thing as a Dixocrat. The only difference between George Wallace and Lyndon Johnson is one of them's wife got cancer. That's the only difference. You go for it because you chumps. You go for it. The only thing that's going to free Huey is gunpowder. Black powder. That's no victory, that's a concession. When black people become serious about the revolutionary struggle that they are caught up in, whether they recognize it or not, when they begin to go down and knock off people who are oppressing them and begin to render these people impotent, that's when the revolutionary struggle unfolds. Not until.
We have to recognize who our major enemy is. The major enemy is not your brother, flesh of your flesh, and blood of your blood. The major enemy is the honky and his institutions of racism. That's the major enemy. That is the major enemy. And whenever anybody nobody prepares for revolutionary warfare. You concentrate on the major enemy. We're not strong enough to fight each other and also fight him. We will not fight each other today. We will not fight each other. There will be no fights in the black community among black people. There will just be people who will be off. There will be no fights. There will be no destruction. We are going to be united. We must begin to develop, number one, and this is the most important thing we can do as a people. We must first develop an undying love for our people. Our people. Our people. Our people. We must develop an undying love as is personified in Brother Huey P. Newton. Undying love for our people. Undying love. If we do not do that, we will be wiped out. We must develop an undying love for our people. Our slogan will become, first, our people, then, and only then, me and you as individuals. Our people first. Our people first.
Huey Newton is the only living revolutionary in this country today. He has paid his dues. He paid his dues. How many white folks you killed today? But you revolutionaries, you are revolutionaries. Che Guevara says it's only two ways to leave the battlefield, victorious or dead. Huey is in jail. Johnson can always sit up and talk about, he can always raise an argument about law and order because he never talks about justice. But black people fall for that same argument and they go around talking about lawbreakers. We did not make the laws in this country. We are neither morally nor legally confined to those laws. Those laws that keep them up keep us down. You got to begin to understand that. And in ending, I'm going to end in the Swahili saying. It says, Lasima Tusinda Bila Shaka, Bila Shaka, which means, we shall conquer without a doubt. Black power.
And so in talking about Brother Huey Newton tonight, we have to talk about the struggle of black people, not only in the United States, but in the world today, and how he becomes part and parcel of that struggle, how we move on so that our people will survive America. All right. Therefore, we are not talking about politics tonight. We're not talking about economics tonight. We are talking about the survival of a race of people. That is all that is at stake. We are talking about the survival of black people. Nothing else. Nothing else. Nothing. And he will consciously wipe us out. He will consciously wipe us out. Let us check World War II. He will not do it unto his own. Notice who he dropped an atomic bomb on. Some helpless yellow people in Hiroshima. Some helpless yellow people in Hiroshima. In Hiroshima. If you do not think he's capable of committing genocide against us, check out what he's doing to our brothers in Vietnam. Check out what he's doing in Vietnam. We have to understand that we're talking about our survival and nothing else. Whether or not this beautiful race of people is going to survive on the earth. That's what we're talking about. Nothing else. Nothing else. If you do not think he's capable of wiping us out,
check out the white race. Wherever they have gone, they have ruled, conquered, murdered, and plagued. Whether they are the majority or the minority, they always rule. They always rule. Always rule. And check out the pattern in which they move. They came to this country. They didn't know a damn thing about this country. The red man showed them how to adapt to this country. He showed them how to grow corn. He showed them how to hunt. And when the Indians finished showing it, he wiped them out. He wiped them out. He wiped them out. He was not satisfied. He went to South America. The Aztec Indians said, this is our silver. This is our copper. These are our medals. These are our statues. We build them for the beauty of our people. After the Indians showed it to him, he took it and he wiped them out. He wiped them out. He's been able to make us hate each other. He has transplanted that hate and the love for each other for a love of his country. His country. We came to this country as black men and as Africans. It took us 400 years to become Negroes. Understand that. That means that the concept of a black man is one who recognizes his cultural, his historical, and the roots of his great ancestors who were the greatest warriors on the face of this earth. Africans. 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 Many of our people's minds have been whitewashed. If a Negro comes up to you and you turn your back on him, he's got to run to the hunky. We're going to take time and patience with our people because they're ours. They're ours. All of the Uncle Toms, we're going to sit down and we're going to talk. And when they slap, we're going to bow. And when they slap, we're going to bow. And we're going to try to bring them home. And if they don't come home, we're going to off them. That's all. That's all. The 3 M's, the missionaries, the money, and the Marines. That is precisely the way it's moved all over the world. It is the way it moves against us. They have sent the missionaries in. We sent them out. They have sent the money in with the poverty program. The Vietnamese and the Koreans are pulling the money out. The next thing comes the Marines. Comes the Marines. And if we're talking seriously, we get prepared for the Marines. Now, if some black people do not think that the white man is going to wipe us out completely, then it won't be no harm being prepared just in case he decides to do it. Just in case he decides to do it. So there'll be no harm in us preparing ourselves for the Marines. Now, there's a lot of tactics we can learn. The VC is showing us the best way to get it done. Best way to get it done. And don't be afraid to say it. Tell them, yeah, you want the Vietnamese to defeat them because they're wrong from the jump. They're wrong from the jump. They're wrong. They're wrong. Don't get...
Black power, black power, black nation. You're tuned into In Defense of the People weekly Tuesday night broadcast at 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, People's Political Party National Chair, Nat Turner, and co-host myself, Brother Motherland, National Minister of Defense, and also our engineer on the ones and twos, Sister Amon, our National Minister of Communication. Call in each and every Tuesday night, same black place, same black time, at 845-277-9266. Press 1 to participate. Tonight's topic, Black August, week 4. We're going to take and open up our lines to our national chairman, Brother Nat Turner. Black power, chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Black power, chairman, can you hear you loud and clear?
Right on. Yeah. Man, you know, we be facing challenges, you know, and our... move, you know, to make a contribution to the struggle, you know. But tonight, I want to go into the, I'm just trying to get myself a little comfortable here, but I want to talk about, of course, you know, this Black August Month, you know. Now, we've been dealing specifically with that. It was subject matter, what it specifically pertains to, and particularly political prisoners in this country. You know, that the state denies having. Of course, you know, it's in denial about a great many things, and evil would never relinquish the truth, because it would, in essence, be, you know, cutting off its own head. So it has to keep constantly perpetuating the lies, you know, the propaganda, the dumbing down of society, you know, what is put in new 21st century terms as social engineering. You know, whereas, you know, in the past, you know, we referred to it as brainwashing, you know, mind control. The general public, for particular reasons, of course, you know, naturally, you know, for those who are the proprietors, stakeholders, you know, the stockholders, the owners of the, you know, the means of production, the corporations and the companies, along with their comrades and government, which therefore makes them fascists, a concerted effort or collaboration or conjoining or combining of the government and the corporations in league together, running the show. And I've said it before, and this is a political explanation, not only us, you know, having the sense enough to understand and know, but straight out of the mouth of an avowed fascist himself in the middle of the 20th century, one Benito Mussolini, who was a leader, whatever you want to call it, the prime minister, president, or what have you, of the Italian government, that the state, as hypocritical as it was, still is during, you know, during that time, I'm referring to the Italian government, the Italian system is fascist. Mussolini was proud of that. He didn't make no qualms about it. He didn't apologize. He didn't go around sneaking around, you know, using camouflage and all types of cosmetics and bullshit. No, he was out and open and avowed fascist, and he said that the Americans were no different than him, that they were fascist too. The only difference is that the Americans dressed their shit up better than everybody else. You know, they was accusing Hitler of a similar type of behavior or mentality, fascism, you know, under the guise of Nazism. And it's a whole lot that people really don't understand, don't get, the dumbing down of society, being preoccupied with the American decadent culture, which has numbed a huge portion of this country's population to reality, to some type of understanding where they can begin to start thinking for themselves. You know, I say all that to say this. The chief, we can say, protagonist of Black August and what it stands for, is George Jackson. And we're not going to say George Jackson enough, who indulged in what is referred to by the state as crime, what we refer to as street activities. Some see it as an excuse to excuse those of us who have done crime, yet they lack the same type of tenacity when it comes to America itself as one big, huge criminal enterprise. All of a sudden, they seem to go stuck on stupid or running off into what's referred to as selective amnesia, turn the light switch of their brain on and off whenever they see fit, when it's comfortable for them. Yeah, George Jackson, political prisoner, when he began to reconstitute himself to win his humanity back from a decadent society. And so he felt redeemed or, you know, reconstituted when he met, you know, Mao, you know, leaders of the People's Revolution around the world in over the past, let's say, 100 years. Lenin, Marx, and other revolutionary theorists who had diligently studied this system of things, and particularly the capitalist system. And they articulated it very well to their people, its internal contradictions and also its external contradictions on an international scale. But George Jackson had became very effective in the prison system, what we refer to as the concentration camps throughout America, the American gulags, critical of the Russians having gulags and political prisoners, and they were no better than the Russians themselves. So a part of his understanding and evolution and growth and development and the realization of the ultimate, and that was a understanding of the situation that black people had found themselves in this country, politically, economically, socially, and inside the prison system, dealing with racism on the part of those whose role and goal and objective was to control the segment of the black population within the prison environment, the penal colony. And so George Jackson began to, as I said, you know, study diligently and even studied martial arts, you know, in a survival mode in such a harsh place where one can instantly lose the rest of his humanity, the sum that he had or she had when they entered the so-called correctional system of America, which has ballooned today into the prison industrial complex. And so his ultimate understanding led to him becoming a member of the Black Panther Party. As Field Marshal George and a lot of his comrades knew him, and those who are still alive speak of him as Comrade George, as though they were speaking about him yesterday on Monday, you know. And his elevation to that stage was also the result of him forming a family, initially referred to as the Black Family, around 1966, having having been in you know, the penal colony for 5 or 6 years, beginning in 1961. And so that ballooned into what is known today as the Black Guerrilla Family. He started out meeting other brothers who had become revolutionary in their state of mind, understanding that crime and politics go hand in glove. A lot of us like to say hand in hand, but we see it fitting as hand in glove. And so some of these OGs, if I may, refer to known as Big Jake Lewis, W.F. Nolan, you know, who was a boxing champ, you know, in the so-called prison system. And these brothers shaped the Black Guerrilla Family. And the Black Guerrilla Family, in essence, was the prison wing, you know, of the Black Liberation Movement. There are several facets to the Black Liberation Movement, above ground, below ground. You know, those who had carefully picked, you know, this old saying when we're talking about, choose your own poison. You know what I'm saying? And in some instances, there's nothing wrong with choosing your own poison, especially when one has a goal and objective, you know, to take back their lives into their own hands. As Malcolm X had taught us, you know, by any means necessary. And if you look at even, you know, the formation of what is referred to as gangs in America, you see a culture in itself, you know, due to a societal imbalance the wealth, the material wealth, you know, the consummation of wealth, or the consuming of wealth, the so-called spreading of the wealth. And so there are these conditions that naturally arise, hardcore conditions, these concrete conditions that take place. So, you know, the camaraderie that one feels within his or her environment, you know what I'm saying? This country is split up in the sectors, districts, wards. And the word ward itself is very interesting. You know, so if you look at the word ward, and what do you see in the term? You know what I'm saying? If you add a few letters to the word ward, what do you have? So there's no coincidence that one term itself pretty much can sum up what we were speaking about tonight. You end up taking the word ward in a flash, you know, in a nutshell. You know, in other words, you know, the word ward, WARD. You know, you take the D off, you have war. So you add the D to it, you have a concentrated area, a concentrated environment, a locale, you know what I'm saying? And, of course, right next to the ward, on the outskirts of the ward, you have what's called, referred to as a precinct, you know what I'm saying? A police precinct. You see what I'm saying? And so if you take those out of the ward, who are labeled as criminals because of the street activities due to the blowback of again of a particular type of governmental decadence on the part of those who have been entrusted with the leadership of making this claim as being democratic and was actually established as a republic. You know what I'm saying? So when you take those out of the particular ward and you place them in another controlled environment, this environment It's the place you go to pay for your crimes or you know, serve time. And so over that prison system, the person that's placed over that prison system is a warden. So you add an E-N onto the word warden, you have a warden, you know, who in essence is the governor of that particular prison system. You see, and so all of these things, they go hand in glove. I'm saying, but in your environment, there's a type of camaraderie that develops. You know, of course, the word camaraderie, you see, is similar to the, you know, term of comrade. You see, and so there develops some type of affection for one another due to the material conditions. And so this is the evolution of what state refers to as a gang. You understand what I'm saying? And so if you take even your white gangs, these white gangs that develop, you know, in the 40s, you know, the 30s, the 40s, and, you know, in between the Great Depression and World War II or what have you. These Europeans, as a matter of fact, there's a movie called The Gangs of New York, you know, that they glamorize. You know what I'm saying? And none of these gangs is black. You know, these are white gangs, you know, Irish gangs, you know, the Italian gangs, and what have you. You know what I'm saying? And so a lot of these characters who end up becoming public officials or you know, elected officials, you know, derive from these white gangs where they were quote unquote terrorizing the communities and had carved up, you know, their districts. Of course, in New York, you know, split up in the boroughs. You know what I'm saying? So, that territory, in essence, in a sense, became, you know, their territory, their bounds, their jurisdiction, what have you. And the state can see this as advantageous if it's used in the proper sense, in the proper way to prevent some type of upheaval, you know what I'm saying? So on a smaller scale, being inside was referred to the prison system in this concentration camps because you were concentrated, you know, in an environment. It was just like in the camps when they you know, the so-called POWs in Vietnam, you know, the were captured, soldiers were captured, become prisoners of war. And, of course, you know, they make these movies, you know, Rambo 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, and then 20, and 5th, and 4, you know it. It'd be 100 Rambo movies made, and offshoots of that, you know. But it's no different. It's just on a national or could be on a local level as opposed to an international level, you know, prisoners of war. After all, this is war that's being orchestrated, carried against black people, particularly black and brown people, you know, on a larger scale in general. You know, some course, you know, yeah, some well, what about the poor whites, man? Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, all right, yeah, poor whites too, you know. It's class contradiction, it's class antagonism between the rich whites and the poor whites, and, the, you know, poor whites feeling some kind of way, but it's a trick to it. And we'll get into that at some point in the future, you know, because there's always somebody watching, there's always somebody listening, you know, especially when you have black organizations or black formations, black militants who declare black power, you know what I'm saying, red, black, and green, black nationalism. Of course, these talking heads, these pundits, the media, you know, trying to take advantage of that and you know, through propaganda and labeling it as reverse racism, black supremacy, you know, when the great Khalid Muhammad was alive. You know, it was in the Nation of Islam. Spokesman. He can go around and couldn't speak. He used fiery speeches, and he, you know, using these terminologies. You know what I'm saying? Using terminology because it's American way. You know what I'm saying? When we say, you know, honky and cracker and redneck, the whites sees the opportunity and say, see, that's racism. He's a racist. You know what I'm saying? But so. We're not afraid or hesitant to, yeah, you know, okay, you poor whites have these, you know, their problems, you know, to peer out on the service, you know, that black people and poor whites have the same enemy. You know what I'm saying? But you know, it's very clear, you know, to us. And so in the prison system, you know, this environment. And so the same type of camaraderie that's in the larger society begins to take effect inside the prison system, knowing that, of course, you know, the state has always been racist. So every tentacle of the state has its own vestiges of some type of institutionalized racism, some type of mentality of those in charge, you know, in defense of their whiteness, in the preservation of their white rule. And so in the prison system, it's a control system. It's a control system. And when you're speaking in political context, political leaders, is a system to be used to break those who are seen as dissidents, those who are problems, troublemakers, or what have you, boat rockers, or what you want to call it. You know what I'm saying? So this is George Jackson. And, of course, the camaraderie of these brothers had to realize that they deep behind enemy lines.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised.
Right on. Yeah, I'm back. Can you hear me, comrade? I can't hear you if you responded, but I hope you can hear me. You know what I'm saying? And of course, this too. You know what I'm saying? We expect these types of things to take place. We don't believe that they're all coincidences. You know, the disconnecting of the phone, the disruption of this show, this program, you know, using various forms of electronic gadgets and stuff. You know, hopefully, the listeners, you know, can hear me. And of course, my point where I left off at was a natural response to the conditions, to the hostile conditions.
Yeah, you
being,
back on, Chapman? You back live?
Okay, right. So you can hear me. All right, right on. Yeah. So the natural response where I left off at, the natural response being inside a controlled environment where you're basically we can say vulnerable, if not completely vulnerable, to the whims of those who rule over you. You know what I'm saying? And so this is a natural response to that. And so that is how the family, derived the evolution of the family on the part of George Jackson, you know what I'm saying, who is trying to, in a specific manner, as a form of insulation against, you know, the opposing forces, you know, in the prison system, you know, the racist white prisons. You know, the white gangs or the white neo-Nazis or Aryan, whatever you want to call it. You know what I'm saying? Of course, you know, coming off the heels of World War II, Adolf Hitler's disciples, you know what I'm saying? You know, had, you know, morphed into, you know, the neo-Nazi movement, the white supremacist movement, whatever you want to call it, using the swastika, you know, as their logo, tattoos and what have you and stuff like that. And so, this is the evolution of the family. You know what I'm saying? Give the black prisoners something which to hold on to in protection. You know what I'm saying? So that, of course, became known as the Black Guerrilla Family. The more and more it took shape, the more and more it began to develop its ideology, its particular type of function. You know, of course, you know, a gorilla is what? You know what I'm saying? We don't mean, you know, the black gorilla, you know, the ape in the jungle, you know what I'm saying, in Africa. You know what I'm saying? The gorilla, those who seek to fight their oppressor from a particular perspective. You know, the word Gora, you know, one who fights. You know what I'm saying? And of course, in this case, you know, it deals with the oppressor. And so the term gorilla, and this has been popularized in places around the world. You know, we could say more specifically, you know, in Latin America. You know what I'm saying? We had several guerrilla fighters who have become proficient with an excellent understanding of the guerrilla fighter. So that morphed into the Black Guerrilla Family. On a larger note, George Jackson also having understood, like you said, you know, he came into contact with Mao and Marx and Lenin, you know, Ho Chi Minh, what have you, and began to understand the system of capitalism itself and how the prison system is part and parcel of the capitalist system, you know, how being exploited on the outside, once you get on the inside, you become even more exploited at the hands of these companies and corporations who, in essence, are getting free labor for the production and production of their products, of their so-called consumer goods. You see, and so George Jackson took advantage of the whole situation, get the prison population to see the state as its enemy due to the circumstance, due to the situation, due to the contradictory nature of declaring on one end to be democratic, a democracy, and on the other end, race and class, you see. And so in the process of that, in his, you know, his group, his development, his reaching the apex of his understanding, ended up in the culmination of two books that he had written. And, of course, one was Blood of My Eye, you know. And this is a book that the state, of course, would be opposed to naturally because of what it espouses. You know, George Jackson's political theoretical views due to a very tedious understanding, you know, of the capitalist system, you know, the rich, you know, these rich families, you know, the shareholders, the stakeholders who steer, of course, the basic thing is referred to as the means of production, where one sells his or her labor, you know, to a company or corporation referred to as a job, as an employer and the employee, you know what I'm saying? And on top of that, on the side, the employer has his company set up in the larger sector referred to, you know, as you know, the stock exchange or, you know, Wall Street, you know, what have you, trading, you know, and you know, one accumulating shares in this company and that company, what have you. You see, and so here you're working manually your physical labor, and on the side they also exploit your physical labor by collecting quarterly checks worth millions of dollars. You know, you know, a letter, you know, with a government seal, or, you know, a state government seal, or whatever, and this letter worth, you know, so and so, due to you being an owner of 10, 15, 20, 30, 100,000 shares, but you didn't earn that that wealth through those shares. You got it off the backs of those who worked in the company or the corporation in which, you know, you have partaken in their shares. And so this is exploitative nature of capitalism. You know, whereas, in other words, those who perform the labor in these plants, you know, the production facilities, such as the automobile industry, And this is what George Jackson understood, you know, and how the auto workers are being exploited. And this is the very reason why, again, due to these opposing forces, these hostile forces, that is the evolution of unionism, you know, where the whites, you know, coming out of the 19th century, you know, into the 20th century, developed, you know, this concept of unionism because of the big bosses was exploiting them. You know, and so, you know, this thing about hourly wage and you know, a control on work hours, you know, per day. And this is the evolution of now why they have such things as overtime, why the 8-hour regulatory hours of work per day became in these codes, mandates, laws, what have you. You understand what I'm saying? You know, those who are being exploited. So they form unionism to do what? To protect what? Their interests. To protect their interests. And in a lot of cases, of course, you cross the color line. You know what I'm saying? But you can never leave out the fact that that black people, if the whites were going through it, and the blacks had to go through it, double as worse. Because it resulted in a racing class. And if you was a black woman, and the black woman ended up having more problems than anybody else, race, class, and sexism. You know what I'm saying? On the job. You know? And so this is why black people have to say, okay, yeah, that shit's cool, but look, I'm not only getting a shaft because of my class, but I'm getting the fucking shaft really because I'm black. You know what I'm saying? So we have to develop some kind of black shit too, you know, on the side. Or that shit's on the side. This is the prime thing right here. I can never write a book or a paper or essay or what have you entirely class and race. You know what I'm saying? That paper will have to be titled Race and Class. And if it was a black woman or a young sister writing it, she titled Race, Class, and Sexism. You know, I believe Angela Davis has a book along those lines, you know. But this is what George Jackson understood. And so this is what made him so potent in the prison system, because he was getting to raise the conscious level of his immediate surrounding time, those who looked like him, and, of course, the white prisoners who were interested, the white prisoners who got beyond their whiteness, who struggled in the battle with their own white selves and were able to confiscate that for the most part enough to where it got them to the point where they could even understand what George Jackson was saying. Of course, you know, he was a Marxist-Leninist, you know, and so Marx, I mentioned Marx more than I mentioned Lenin, but Karl Marx, German philosopher, in tandem with his comrade Frederick Engels, had written numerous books, explaining the inevitable downfall of the capitalist system due to his, you know, to his contradictions, due to the conflict within itself. And of course, it involves, you know, the working class people. And, of course, this is in Europe. He didn't set foot in Africa and see during that time in the 1840s. You know what I'm saying? 1840s, 50s, shit, we talking about like straight dominating rule into the late 19th century, 1880s. By then, chopping up Africa, Berlin Conference of 1884, where the whites, who call themselves NATO now, got together and they sat, you know, in Berlin and they, you know, called themselves trying to take a map of what they thought was Africa and carve it up amongst themselves like you do in Christmas, you know, when you family get together, they say the prayer, bless the food, and then, you know, the man of the house, he take the, you know, the knife and the fork, you know, and he cuts the turkey, what have you, stuff like that, you know. And he was smart enough to understand, well, you know, here's a white man who knows his shit better than anybody else. And so we look into what he's saying and see the contradictions in it, and then we have to take ourselves and place ourselves in it as a race of people, black people, people of African descent who were brought here by force, who were exploited the same way, you know what I'm saying, but amplified a million more times due to the violence that it took, we're showing where the ship at. All right, well, you're fucking right. I'm get on board. No, it wasn't like that. You know what I'm saying? So to be brought here and then to build up the capitalist economy, contrary to what these modern political economists that are hired to do these, you know, to do the bidding on the part of the state and try to convince you where the blacks didn't, capitalism, you know, it wasn't a result of a slavery. It's bullshit. And that's still today. It's still being done today. It was a constant. Keep being going that way. You know what I'm saying? And so, again, you know, what I'm saying is like how I understand it, how I learned it. It's the same way George Jackson had begun to learn it and, began to be such a charismatic person, you know, behind the prison wall. And so in particularly in the California penal colonies in the state of California, you know, and so his eventual political murder, state-backed assassination, August 21st, 1970, you know, and as a result of that, the attempt on the part of his little brother, you know, man-child, Jonathan Jackson, 17 years old, the intrusion into the San Rafael courthouse in Marin County, you know. And as a result of that, you know, the situation that inevitably led to that because of the conditions again, you know. And so with the political murder of George Jackson, the black guerrilla family had to push on, you know. So, of course, there were those who later on in the 70s, taken over the helm. You know, even though there were other brothers who had, of course, at the time, were still part of the original family who were there, you know, what could have been considered as the veterans, you know, of the black guerrilla family, you know. And, of course, the present usage of the term and the name, and, of course, the state, of course, on the part of the media, whose job is always to criminalize the black man at every chance that they get, you know. If you go online, you know, you go online today, and you type in black guerrilla family, and what do you see? You'll see, you know, black guerrilla family prison gang. This prison gang, pretty much, you know, the scum of the earth, you know. You would never know its initial beginnings. You would never know it is a political fashion, you know. The prison wing of the Black Panther Party, Black Liberation Movement, and of course, you know, the Attica Rebellion, New York, was a result, an extension of the murder, the consequences of the murder of George Jackson. The old wardens, the old prison guards, some who may still be alive today, will never concede that. They will never concede that, this word martyr, you know, should be applied, to George Jackson. The thing that George Jackson had proved, or the conclusion that he had reached, was that the revolutionary transformation of society, bar none, that the state would take advantage of reform in another guise. The state, when it, you know, can serve like this animal referred to as a chameleon. You know, the chameleon can morph itself into anything that it attaches itself to and come under duress. There's this incredible genetic chemical ability to transform itself into the color that in nature of course, which it finds itself closest to protect its own self, to preserve its own life. And so this is the state is a chameleon. And so George Jackson realized that the it had to a revolution had to occur, or would have to occur to liberate the people, to get the people beyond the reform stage, lest the state, like I say, would create new ways, innovative ways to reconstitute itself. For instance, you know, a perfect example is coming out of physical slavery, you know what I'm saying, at 1865, you know, officially 1863 or what have you. But there's no coincidence that they had what's called Reconstruction. I mean, it wouldn't take Inspector Gadget or Dr. Phil, you know, figure that shit out for us. Reconstruction. I mean, okay, well, goddamn, you know, Reconstruction. So there couldn't have been a Reconstruction if there was already a construction period. And so what is that construction period based on? Construct? So what was the construct? The construct was what? You know, take the niggas, bring them over here. No, take the Africans, bring them over here by force, turn them into slaves, and then turn them into niggas, and then they can go in, you know, inward on each other, you know, due to the writing on the wall. And so the whites regrouped under Reconstruction. But the trick is to get the people, the population, or those in these, you know, in the public food system, lower the higher education to understand Reconstruction as some great American advance in society, embracing the fact that America is a melting pot, what have you, or trying to resuscitate the Africans, give them some type of upliftment and Reconstruction, and to revamp the laws, you know, that was supposed to make black people part of the system, citizens, the Constitution, the contradictions of the Constitution. And so they reconstructed what they already had in place. And that is the point when they began to, in a sort of sense, sort of become more subtle, more clandestine in their ways, while at the same time the introduction of the Ku Klux Klan, you know, as the ultra right wing non-official military. Let me say that again. As the unofficial ultra right wing military police to keep black people in their place within society, you know, to protect and maintain and keep the status quo, which is why the Ku Klux Klan never suffered the fate of the Black Panther Party. It was always to remain intact. You see, regardless of how much the state outwardly expresses this facade of, you know, condemning the Ku Klux Klan and what have you, the politician gets on TV, even the Republicans, you know, get on TV and condemn the Klan for this despicable act, you know, what have you. But deep down inside, that Ku Klux Klan leader and that politician, whether he's a Democrat or Republican, let me say this again, regardless whether he's a Democrat or Republican, shares the same internal instincts and sentiments in their psyche, and that is white rule. The white structure, the structure that was established when every law known to humanity that we know today that is against the law was being carried out against other human beings who happen to be black and brown people, indigenous people, here in this part of the world. And the blowback now that's developing out of it, that's taking place, and now the whites is running around, you know, worried shitless, you know, due to this spike in this outward expansion of so-called crime into the more affluent areas now. You see. And so with the black guerrilla family and those who have been quote-unquote unleashed, you know, within society. And like I said, if you, you know, you go online, you'll see You type in Black Gorilla Family, what you'll see, you know. The same similar type of tactic, so to speak, to keep the same, the same imagery, you know, applied to the Black Gorilla Family, which didn't start as no gang, you know. And if that's the case, the Black Gorilla Family is a gang, then the police is a gang. You know, it's a licensed organized gang. The IRS is a gang. It's a licensed organized gang to do what? You know, the FBI is a gang. It's a licensed organized gang to do what? The DEA is a licensed organized gang to do what? The ATF is a gang. Organized to do what? SWAT is a gang. A concerted effort, you know, with a stated purpose and goal, you know, to arrest certain criminals who have been deemed, highly toxic. I'm saying very, very, very dangerous. And so to transform this type of this so-called criminal mentality with the ultimate struggling goal, you know, into the revolutionary mentality. And this is what George Jackson realized. No. And we can take a specific person that we can say prove George Jackson's analysis correct, right, you know, and the impact, that it would have on society, you know. And so this one brother we speak of is Al Prentice Bunchy Carter, you know, who was a so-called gang leader. The white man had to label him, you know, in the 60s, in Los Angeles, you know, places that have been familiarized today, due to certain rap group, you know, called N.W.A., Compton, you know, these areas, in South Central, what have you, Los Angeles, California, in general. You know, but Bunchy was the leader of the Slawsons. And if anybody are familiar with the Dr. Dre Chronic album, one of the songs where they, it's a collaborative effort, you know, the whole gang is rapping. And I believe it was Daz or Corrupt, you know, the line where he says, if you think you're bossing, bring your ass on over to Crenshaw and Slawson. You know, he was mentioning that street for a particular reason. It was no coincidence that he gave a shout out to Crenshaw and Slauson. And of course, the more recent times with the murder of Nipsey Hussle, you know, his line clothes and t-shirts, Crenshaw. You know what I'm saying? But here you have a leader of a street tribe that had been transformed or politicized into a revolutionary gangster, conscious revolutionary gangster. And of course, you know, Bunchy having the type of position that he had among the Slawsons, and transform the Slawsons from what the state would have you believe is a criminal gang, you know, to a revolutionary organization. And there's some bunch of old comrades today who are still alive. I've watched one particular interview. Forget the brother's name. But this brother was so adamant. He was so convinced. We even had a faith in Bunchy, or at least we know a confidence in Bunchy as a leader. And he had said that You know, he's talking about, you know, the movement, the struggle, the Black Panther Party, the experiences, and the you know, the different things that have become the Black Panther Party, you know, internal, external. And we talked about Bunchy. He said, well, when they murdered Bunchy, he said, you know, they murdered the movement, you know. And you have to understand where he was coming from, what he meant by that. You know what I'm saying? Being in California, you know, in the conditions, you know, that Oakland can be the epitome of when it comes to Black survival, Black struggle in a system that pits us in this survival of the fittest mentality, which we, you know, in our own way, do or die. Flavor Flav used to say, you know, do or die, you know, it became a slogan in Bed-Stuy. Bed-Stuy is a particular part of New York, of Brooklyn. And so he said, do or die in Bed-Stuy. It was his neighborhood, you know what I'm saying? And that became the slogan, you know, for that part of New York, you know. And so to be able to transform somebody who would be labeled a street gang leader into a revolutionary, to become effective, was the genius of Huey P. Newton, National Defense Man, the founder of Black Panther Party, you know, along with Bobby Seale, you know. And then you add more ingredients to that Los Angeles chapter with one Geronimo Pratt, you know, who had come out of the military, did service in Vietnam, was highly decorated for his, you know, his heroics, his you know, his bravery in Vietnam, and Geronimo himself, you know, talking about coming back, you know, fight a war of liberation right here in his own backyard, you know, after being told there was some liberation struggle of the South Vietnamese people, the dictator. In North Vietnam, known as Ho Chi Minh, and his right-hand man, Comrade Bo Nguyen Jack, you know. And here you have these brothers jailing together, and, of course, the more and more these things begin to take place, the more and more the state begin to become very reactionary and very violent, you know, using violence as the control method, being superior in violence. And this is taught today in these courses, these classes, around the country, you know, the law enforcement, you know, in the academy, in the classroom, you know what I'm saying? Violence is a scientific method, as the supreme. No one should be more superior to you in violence, because violence, at the end of the day, is what it's all about. You see, and there's two types of violence. There's oppressive violence and revolutionary violence as a response to the oppressive violence. And the bastard child of oppressive violence is repression, repressive violence. You know what I'm saying? And so it's very clear on the part of, you know, the likes of you know, George Jackson, you know. And so once you begin to think along those lines, you've elevated your level of thinking, and the determinism that sets in, you know, the realization that Black people can't get out of this unscathed. You know, Malcolm X, you know, he talked about the same thing, you know, the price of freedom, you know. This is his story. This is no new thing that we make up here, or some conversation when we have. Man, right now, if you go online and listen to this radio show, man, called Independent People, man, you got a peaceful little public, you know, talking about advocating violence. You know, you'll seize opportunity. You know, the play on your mind. But what we're doing is we're putting in a historical context and to show you how people end up conditioned forced to do things they don't normally do in a normal life, in a normal lifestyle, a normal set. And so this same violence is not problematic. if it's in a controlled environment where it's just one group of people that everybody look like each other, and it becomes no problem. I'm saying it's not a concern, it's not a worry at all, period. You see what I'm saying? None whatsoever. You know, and when you take the people and put them in a controlled environment, and being in the prison system, this is what the Black Guerrilla family was able to defend themselves against in the hostile environment. You know, so of course, yeah, okay, yeah, you know, one end up in there for murder, one up in there for robbery and what have you, you know, whatnot or whatever, you know. It could have been trespassing. I mean, George Jackson, a gas station robbery, getting one to life, a sentence from one to life, you know. I mean, how you sentence a man one to life, you know, in the so-called civilized world? And like you say, he done 10. You know, longer than anybody else on the one to life. You know, and so the importance of the gang, you know, within the context of maintaining, you know, the structure, right? How beneficial it is to use so-called black-on-black crime as an actual strategy. You know what I'm saying? As an actual strategy. But I want to forget to say, you know, to speak about the Rodney King rebellion. You know, happened years ago. Years of motors pulled over. You know, and they beat the shit out of him. You know, a gang. You know, he was viciously assaulted by a gang of police. You know, Ice Cube made it with a solo album where he rapped about it. You know, and as a result of that, the what came out of it. You know, several things came out of it. And one of the most important things that came out of it was in the Bloods and the Crips realizing that they didn't beat the shit out of Rodney King because he was a Blood or a Crip or any other thing. You know, he could have been gay. You know, he could have been a Christian. A Muslim, a 5%er, you know, Circle 7 Quran follower of the Noble Drew Ali, the Moors, Hebrew Israelite. He could have been Nubian at the time, you know, a lesser known group, you know, even an atheist. He could have been a Masonic brother, a Prince Hall Masonic brother. Could have been coming home on his way from the weekly meeting at the Masonic Hall with his Masonic brothers. But they ain't beat the shit out of him over none of that. They beat the shit out of him. None of that can phase them, period. They didn't see none of that. They saw a black man. And that's what that boiled down to. This was the type of mentality that was inherited from the slave master, from the overseer on the plantation. You know what I'm saying? And so what came out of it? Okay, the first trial, you know, not guilty. You know what I'm saying? And so what happened? You know, of course, the state, you know, when the white pundits media referred to it as a riot. You know, those of us who were wise enough, smart enough at the time, understand, you know, we saw it as a rebellion. And the state actually saw it as a rebellion, too. The potential, you know, to start something that could ultimately end up in the overthrow of our position in society. You know, of course, you know, the fire was put out, but it was a sentiment that came out of that. You know, the most crucial was that you see the Bloods and the Crips. You know, they didn't recognize none of that. They was out there together. You know what I'm saying? And they had never really seen that before. And these brothers realized something about themselves, like, damn, man, you know, we've been tripping, you know, this long, man, and like, look where we at now. You know what I'm saying? Of course, you know, this is 500 years built up of frustration, anger, rage, hurt, and pain, and a whole lot of other shit, dejection, humiliation, denigration, everything, you know, all rolled up into one. You know, one big fat blunt that everybody could take a pull from, you know, and get high off. And so that was one of the most crucial parts about the whole thing, the Rodney King Rebellion. You call it gang troops, you know. And, of course, the state couldn't allow that to stay that way because, you know, the more important factors when you look at the displaced, the downtrodden, you know, the rap group was a duo, rap duo. They're taking what they felt was a perfect name in Atlanta. They took what they felt was a perfect name, and it was one of the coldest names a rap duo could ever name itself, Outkast. And all the potential in the world, you know what I'm saying, to transform minds in that part of America, in Atlanta, majority black population, or one of the areas where black people are heavily concentrated at, which makes Atlanta a sort of target more than what would be, you know, the little small tiny population in the state of Wisconsin or Minnesota. You know, do they got black people in North Dakota? You know what I'm saying? South Dakota, some of these states we even forget exists on a map. You understand what I'm saying? But, yeah, you know, the outcasts, the black underclass. As a matter of fact, there's a book that was written after the rebellions in the 60s, where brother went into Los Angeles, and literally went and spent some time there. He went in the so-called ghetto, you know, and he talked with the brothers on the streets and interviewed them and whatnot. And he ended up writing this book called The Black Underclass. And in this book, he summed it up. And this is the type of work, you know, the sociologists do, you know, those who go and look at society and see the ills of society, or, you know, and they, you know, they write the shit out, you know, they explain it, you know, and more times than not, what do they say? Due to an imbalance in the landscape, you know, those who are, these terms they use are not, you know, man, it's a whole range of them, you know, disproportionately, so and so with this, you know, disadvantaged children, you know, yeah, you mean low black boys in general. You know, so the whites, you know, they have to create these terminologies to kind of, to sort of psych themselves out, you know, but you know what they mean though, you know what they mean by that, you know, but that was one important stage in our advancement toward the struggle with the Rodney King Rebellion. Now, like I said, you know, the state couldn't allow it to stay that way. There's a documentary named Bastards of the Party. Featured this brother named Bone, who's actual blood, who played, you know, his real name in the movie Training Day. You know, the part where, you know, Alonzo, when he go back into the hood where, you know, visit his little Latino girlfriend, what have you, and stuff. And, you know, whenever the peers come across, there's all these things, you know, where they let loose a flock of doves or whatever, you know, pigeons or something. You know, let the brothers know, you know, on the black note, you know, here come Alonzo or what have you, the police, you know. And this is the brother that takes the pistol, places it down on the ground and tells Alonzo, cat, now, homie, you know, Ryan, you got to put in your own work. And Alonzo lighting the cigarette. He's like, okay, so it's like that, huh, Bone? He said, yeah, it's like that. And that was sweet revenge on the part of Bone, but, you know, it's like, you know, and, you know, Bone, like when he left the first time, and, you know, they give Bone, a couple of lines. Just, yeah, man, I hate that motherfucker. Man, I can't stand that motherfucker. So it was a sweet revenge to see how ironic a white cop, getting the ups on a black, cop, a black detective. So that was subliminal shit. But the point is that the brother Bone, the documentary was shot featuring him. And if you listen to, you hear Bone explaining some things. When you get around the police, explaining Bone about, why is it so easy to kill and this and that. Bone goes into this thing. He's like, you ask him if you've been hunting. You can't really hear, the person response behind the camera because it wasn't mic'd up. But I think he might have told him, yeah. It's okay. It's like going hunting. It's okay. So when you go hunting, right? You got your rifle, you got your scope, and if you spot a deer, and you put the deer in your scope, you do your little thing, whatever, like you've been taught, how to shoot, whatever. He said you pull the trigger, but no problem. You ain't hesitate. You ain't sit there and think, oh man, you ain't feel sorry for the deer. None of that shit. All that shit went out the window. He said, okay, well, that's what it's like. It's the same thing like going hunting. I look at this, I see an animal. He said, because that's what I become. And so he literally gave what I think is the dopest explanation that anybody want to understand and learn and then try to figure the shit out how he got that way, And so when he gets to the other parts about how he, was able to raise his conscious level, it's always, of course, I just, cats that go to prison, they learn, man, one of my closest comrades was like that. But Bone is just trying to explain, how he come around, woke up, not all the way, most of the way, and still, elevating and elevating and elevating. Just like Monster Cody. Formerly known as Monster Cody, currently known as Sanyika Shakur, and man, shit, for the state to learn that he done went from Monster Cody to Sanyika Shakur, I mean, that says it all right there. That's alarming, and a lot of people take that for granted. You know what I'm saying? But so here's Bone explaining. The more and more he started going back and trying to learn the history of the Bloods and the Crips, even the Crips, it was evolution, going back and back. He realized it was more of a brotherly thing, self-preservation, so to speak. And then it started going back, and he realized he landed onto Bunchy Carter. And then, you go back past Bunchy, boom, what did he do? He had rock bottom. The Black Panther Party. And that's why the title of the documentary is called Bastards of the Party. You see? So from the Black Panther Party, the Bunchy, on to the current present time today, with the street tribes, In that documentary also, these brothers literally come together, they're sitting down at a park somewhere or some location. And dual filming, and Anthony Fuqua, the same dude who shot the Training Day. I thought it was a white boy that made the movie. I found out he was black. I was like, what? He's black? I'm like, damn, And so there's a scene where Bloods and Crips, OGs, and his brother from the Blood, the Crips are like, he's like, yeah, man. So man, look, man, I'm a just throwing so this that another OG, and man, I'm straight up 100. He's like, what you saying there? He's like, what the homie saying, man, is like real shit, man. How we was able to, to start recognizing, man, start realizing it was bigger than us. He said, but look, he said, and going to show, he said, you right. He said, how the state do, how the police or the government will do, to get us back at it one another. He said, for instance, what they did was, he said, they stole a car. They stole a car and did a drive-by. Did a drive-by I forget specifically which way he said it was. It may have been them toward the Bloods or to get them to think it was the Bloods that did a drive-by. And these were police officers, the undercovers, the detectives, undercover, to do what? To reignite, this so-called gang war, because it's beneficial. It's a strategy. It's a tactic. you know, consummating in black-on-black crime, and black-on-black crime is no more than a necessary political tool on the part of the state to prevent revolutionary change, a revolutionary transformation of society. So all these other things, you know, people get to going on about black-on-black crime, how it's a shame, and these brothers ain't got to kill each other like that and whatnot. You know, they have absolutely no idea the true nature or the treachery of their own government, the people that they go vote for and you know take part in this voting process, to make them feel like they belong, like they're part of something, like they vote counting, and if it wasn't for me, then Biden would be fucking president, whatnot, this whole little thing. And I'm not talking about no 18-year-old. I'm talking about motherfuckers who 38, 48, 58, and even 68. Completely missed the boat. You know what I'm saying? And so this is what they're willing to do by any means necessary. They've hijacked the slogan of Malcolm X and turned around and used it to their own benefit. You know, the beneficiaries of these types of tactics. To reignite the shit. And of course, the media can step in and keep doing their thing. You know, and with the Rodney King rebellion, it was a little bit. We realized that we had exposed the holes. You know, the brothers had exposed the weaknesses of the state after having portrayed itself through in these movies. You know, with this high tech weaponry and soldiers and whatnot, you know, and all these movies, you know, Rambo movies, Arnold Schwarzenegger made tens of millions of dollars, you know, playing in these movies, you know, nothing but violence, you know what I'm saying? So it was a whole gang of them. But, you know, this social engineering thing to get you to believe that these people is invincible, you know what I'm saying? But how tight their system was, and they exposed them. And so what happened, what came out of that, was a new program on the part of the military industrial complex, and this is real shit. I'm making this up. I'm talking about they spent record money into revamping and adding on, innovating, you know, for future unrest due to the inherent nature of the police, because they know eventually there's going to be another Rodney King. And so what they do to prepare themselves, the inability to be humanistic on their part, on the part of the captives to be humanistic, their inability to do it. So they know in their subconscious there's going to be another one. So instead of preventing another one from taking place, no, they, you know, went into, you know, their war chest, created a system to handle it, to be prepared the next time. And that is what the Rodney King Rebellion exposed. So they weren't so bad after all. They weren't so fucking tight after all. They weren't so dope after all. You understand what I'm saying? And so now you have this FEMA program, you know, these things, these government agencies in place now. Some shit called Jade Helm, you know, like Helm Paint. You know, check that out. You know, urban preparedness strategy, urban preparedness, so-and-so. What is urban preparedness? What is that shit? Urban preparedness is just what it is. It's just what it is. Now, the George Floyd thing is escalated. It's much more escalated and much more sophisticated than the Rodney King rebellion. There's a different result. You know, you had, you know, the black talking heads, you know, after the fire was put out, talking about it's a damn shame, but they ain't doing all this, but burning down their own shit. This, that, and other. That may be true. But the George Floyd ones is a total difference, or greatly different. then the Rodney King rebellion. You know, this time, they ain't burned down only their shit. You know what I'm saying? As a matter of fact, it don't seem like they burned down none of their shit when America was on fire, the city was on fire. You see? And so who came under attack? The corporations and the companies came. They shit came under attack. Even CNN building, you know. And so this is an advance in the struggle that people take for granted. And who was in the midst of it? You know, the street tribes. You know, and you cannot look at that and say, well, just a coincidence that George Jackson dead and gone, you know, and it had nothing to do with it. You'd be fooling yourself. You'd be fooling yourself. You understand what I'm saying? You'd be fooling yourself. And this is the type of thing that's the ultimate, you know, in Chicago, you know, Fred Hampton, you know, the deputy chairman of the North Chapter of the Black Panther Party, Chairman Fred, his ability, so much so that he exemplified what J. Edgar Hoover referred to as the rise of a black messiah and his impact on the street tribes of Chicago. His impact was so crucial that even at his funeral, some of the brothers that came through there in procession, you would have thought they were members of the Black Panther Party, but they were actually members of the street tribes, and that's the type of impact that he had. And of course, you had Jeff Fort, you know, during that time, his contemporary. You know, leader the Black Stones, Peace Stone Nation. And even in their evolution, their growth and development, you know, into El Rukin, you know, which became Islamic leaning, you know. And the state wasn't having it. And so what was the result of that? The setup of Fort, you know, with this thing about Jeff Fort acquiring, you know, weaponry from Gaddafi's Libya, you know, which is the current, you know, state of his incarceration, you know. But I was told that there was an interview with Jeff Fort, and Jeff Fort was asked what was the greatest thing that ever happened to Chicago, and Jeff Fort told them Fred Hampton, and they wanted Jeff Fort, or expected Jeff Fort, to say Michael Jordan, so Jeff Fort would never get out of prison due to his understanding and the influence that he had. Of course, you know, the movie Judas and the Black Messiah. And for the record, that movie was about COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program. It was a focus on that to get, you know, us today to under this is what we're up against. This is the potential of the state then. It's the potential of the state today. You know, those who come in our midst and infiltrate, you know, our organizations. You know, quote, you are better than me or any other brother and sister. You know what I'm saying? And the strategy, you know, of course, you know, you have, you know, the El Rukin in the so-called prison system, and you if you type in El Rukin, and you there's this. There's these departments. I mean, it's a constant. They can't label El Rukin like we would speak of El Rukin. No, they got to continue to call them a gang, a criminal gang. And this is the current status of the Black Guerrilla Family, you know. So they got to keep continually referring to them as a gang so they can't gain any steam in the minds of the masses. You know, and that is a strategy. That is a strategy. It's similar to what they did back in the late 80s, the early 90s, by labeling certain part of rap, certain lyrics or rap artists, taking their music and referring to it as gangster rap. You know, I believe it was Ice-T or Ice Cube, or one of them had said that we never called our music gangster rap, West Coast rap music. We never referred to it as gangster rap. They said that it was the media that had done that. And they'd do it for a reason. It was a reason why, you know, they had to label, you know, that kind of music gangster rap. You know, again, to take away from the fact that you had rap groups like Public Enemy or the X-Clan, KRS-One, you know, the leader of Boogie Down Productions, you know, in New York. You know what I'm saying? And so they had to do something, you know, to throw out the potential in the rap community. You know, these brothers were able to make much headway in the streets. You know, they were politicized, you know, the brothers on the streets using lyrics and music and beats and the culture. And so what did they do? Here come the corporations and the companies again to do what? Here come, you know, with the malt liquor companies. And so what do they do? You know, boom. You know, they shell out money to the more vulnerable rappers. You know, the one particular one that come to mind was St. Ives. And even so much so that, you know, Ice Cube actually did the St. Ives commercial. You know, the crooked eye, you know, St. Ives. That's how the commercial ended. You know what I'm saying? We were like, man, if Rakim do one, man, we it must be the inner rap. It must be the inner hip hop. You know. But that's a tactic, that's a strategy, you know, that they was willing to do to prevent the transformation of the so called gangs, like George Jackson had said, from the criminal mentality to the revolutionary mentality. You know, this has been studied intricately. You know, as I've discovered, it's been studied intricately. You know, the so-called gang culture. You know, the state has its man. You know, they has its man. You know, they have a branch, a study of everything. You know what I'm saying? Asian policy studies. You know, they have a department that studies Russian culture, Russian politics, you know. But they got their man, Dr. George Knox, who actually wrote a book titled An Introduction to Gangs, you know, and it was published. Maybe some of the point or whatever, we running out of time, but I just wanted to mention him right quick, you know, as the head of what's referred to as the National Gang Crime Research Center, you know, I think in the University of Minnesota, you know, and this is that man, whenever they want to understand, you know, the gang culture, what have you, stuff like that, this is the person that they turn to, you know. In this book, he has different like essays, and I got a hold of one of his essays years ago, and the name of his essay is called "Gangs, Guerrilla Warfare, and Social Conflict." Now, if that ain't George Jackson, I don't know what is. Gangs, guerrilla warfare, and social conflict. See, that's the impact of George Jackson and the Black Guerrilla Family. You know, and in that paper, he clearly says that the gangs were able to organize like the just like the U.S. military. The U.S. military and the street gangs are, in essence, no difference because they both practice violence. But the only difference in the sense is that the U.S. military has organized is into scientific violence. And he stated that the gangs had ever reached that stage, then America's days is numbered. You know, his government is numbered. His government's days are numbered. And this is the type of thing, you know, that could be a weakness on their part. You know, their arrogance, you know, being all their military, about how they're so powerful, this, or this is the world's strongest military, blah, 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 this, that, and the other, that they could put stuff out like that, you know, a Freudian slip. You know what I'm saying? But I do want to mention this, that, you know, to cap this night off. You know, now we can revisit, you know, this subject again because there's so much. There's so much, and this is very important, especially with those of us who consider ourselves to be revolutionary in a revolutionary struggle, you know, to demolish this system, to replace the system with a humanistic system, and where black people in particular can be controlled of their own destiny, where we can travel around the earth, you know, it's our homeland, and be at home, you know, be in control of our own destiny, and of course, like Garvey said, Africa for the Africans. The gold, the diamond, the oil, the uranium, the cobalt, even the coltan, which is the reason why we're able to have these cell phones. And without the coltan and the phone, we couldn't be able to, you know, have conversations with one another. You know what I'm saying? Because of this one little ingredient that goes into the phone. You know what I'm saying? That is the wealth and riches of a continent where our people are from. And so, therefore, we should have access to those same riches to where we can enrich ourselves. And, of course, the first thing first is winning our humanity back. And I look on that note, I'm gonna stop right here. And, man, shoot, look, like we say, you know, at the end of the show, man, you know, tune in, you know what I'm saying, next week. You know what I'm saying? Same black time, 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern time. You know, to In Defense of the People's Radio, brought to you by People's Political Party. I'm the one of the co-hosts, Chairman Nat Turner, along with my other co-hosts, our Minister of Defense, Brother Motherland, and our Minister of Communication on a wicked, wicked ones and twos, you know what I'm saying? So, man, on that note, we say black power, you know what I'm saying? All power to the people and your whole rule.
And this is what it feels like. And this is what it feels like. Look, the only reason I survive, cause a nigga is special first. You get successful, then they get stressful thirst. Niggas gon' test you, see what your text is worth. Diamonds and pipes, one of them pressure burst. Street nigga, still I get checks and spurts. I'm for peace, but before I get pressed, I murk. Better days pray for, but expecting worse. At this level, bullshit, I'm just less concerned. Cruising in the six, looking at the proceeds of rap music on my wrist. Drop another mixtape, my shit booming out this bitch. Young Malcolm, I'm the leader of the movement out this bitch. Look, and this is what it feels like. Reach a level, make you question, is it real life? All the weed good, all the pussy real tight. In the only room, keep your dollar bills right. And this is what it feels like. This is what it feels like. And this is what it feels like. And this is what it feels like.
Scorpion bricks. Way before Orbeez double disc, 40 on my lap, clap, sound like 40 did the mix, filtered bass, sip coat, like a Michelin star chef, chef, kiss to my wrist, I go dummy with my left, I arrest on my dick, try to audit all my checks, too late, you know they hate when you become more than they expect, you let them crack a storm your capital, put their feet up on your desk, and yeah, you talking tough to me, I lost all my little respect, I'm selling weed, in the open, bringing folks home from the feds, I know the payback gon' be mean, I'm saving all my little bread, pray for me y'all, one day I'ma have to pay for these thoughts, real niggas is extinct, it ain't safe for me, my dog, they kill killing niggas in they own hood. That makes sense to you at all? You burnt your bridge to the other side. You know you can't swim across. Y'all know niggas can't swim. They fried Mike after he died. Y'all know niggas can't win. You never land on your side. I arrived on the day Fred Hampton got assassinated, just to clarify further. What y'all gave birth is the chairman mixed with Jeff Ford. Big step on the jet with my legs crossed. Black stones on my neck, y'all can't kill Christ. Black Messiah is what I feel like. Shit ain't gon' stop cause y'all spill blood. We gon' turn up even more since y'all killed
cubs. And this is what it feels like. And this is what it feels like. And this is what it feels like. And this is what it feels like.